My name is Scott Hasserud. I serve Holden as the director. And Catherine came to me yesterday and asked me if I would pinch hit here and do a session on Carl Jung. And so I agreed. So actually what this morning's session is about is anything you want to talk about Carl Jung. And she did put on there dreams and other things, so we can talk about other things or dreams or Carl Jung or whatever you would like. I've just by way of background, I'm an ELCA pastor. I've served most of my professional days as a parish pastor. I still think of myself as a parish pastor, just that the congregation keeps changing every day up here. And my hobby over the years has been my interest in where psychology and religion, where psychology and our own spirituality and our own religious experience, where those two kind of come together and meet and help address one another and explain one another. To that end, I got interested in Jung when I was in seminary and became an avid reader of Jung, got involved in my own analysis, went to classes and seminars at various places, eventually ended up teaching part-time at a theological seminary that had a graduate program in psychology, and took a year sabbatical and studied at the Jung Institute in Zurich, Switzerland. So this has been kind of a lifelong interest, you might say. I'm not a Jungian, although some accuse me of being Jung at heart. But I have found Jung's work to be helpful to me in understanding myself, understanding my own religious experience, and in a variety of other ways. So I'm here to just share with you in any way that you'd like this morning. But let me begin by telling you a little bit about Jung and a little bit about some of his central observations about us as people, particularly from a psychic perspective. Have any of you read some of Jung that are here this morning? A little? You have, yeah. Do we have any Jungian analysts in the group? If so, you can take over here. Well, Jung was born in the 1880s and died about 1960. He was the son of a Swiss Reformed minister in Switzerland. Early on, he decided he wanted to become a physician, and then ultimately a psychiatrist, and did that and began working at the Berholtz Clinic in Zurich, Switzerland. And while he was there, he began to make a number of observations about the human psyche. And then by chance met up with Sigmund Freud, who was an older man than he. And as many of you know, Freud was kind of really, in many ways, the founder of the whole psychoanalytic movement in Europe, certainly the father of that movement. And in many ways, the parent of modern-day psychology. And so Jung became kind of Freud's younger disciple, and Freud became Jung's mentor. But then after a number of years, they began to go in different directions, and so there was a split, Jung going his way and Freud continuing his way. And Jung became the founder of what today is known as analytic psychology, and Freud became the founder of what today is known as psychoanalytic psychology. It may sound all the same, but there are some subtle differences. And I'll tell you a little bit about why they split up and went their own ways. Basically, Jung saw the psyche is a wonderful thing. It has very mischievous and difficult pieces and parts to it, but he had a very positive notion about it. And see if I can draw on this board. If this is a picture of you and me, this is us. Basically, Jung divided us into two parts, and he said there's the conscious part of us, that which we know about ourselves, and then there's that which we don't consciously know about ourselves, but yet informs us and shapes us and directs us. And Jung called that part the unconscious. And this was an important word for him, unconscious. Jung called this part of ourselves the subconscious. And there's quite a difference in Jung's understanding of the unconscious and Freud's understanding of the subconscious. And it's one of the reasons why they split and went their own way. The subconscious means that things basically begin up here and get pushed down into the subconscious. The contents of the subconscious for Freud were a lot of stuff that we encounter and get pushed down into the subconscious. And that's too simplistic, but then as opposed to the unconscious for Jung, which was a world of its own, that has its own origins, own roots, that go far beyond us as individual people. Certainly our personal experiences are part of the content of the unconscious, but also what we've inherited from our parents, what we've inherited from our race and our ancestors, and all of that are a part of Jung's notion or ideas or observations about the unconscious. Jung developed then, spent most of his time working on the unconscious, not the conscious. He does have a theory of how of consciousness works. I'll share a little bit about that with you. But most of his time and energy were spent trying to understand how the unconscious works. What's in our unconscious, and how do we get to know what's in the unconscious? One of the ways, of course, we get to know what's in the unconscious is through our dreams. And we'll talk about dreams here in a moment. Anyway, the stuff of the unconscious, what's in the unconscious, Jung called complexes. And that's a word we use a lot. You know, we say so-and-so has a complex, right? Or I have a complex, we'll say, about something. In fact, Jung wanted to call his psychology complex psychology. That's what originally he tried to call it. Because it's a psychology about the complexes, the stuff in our unconscious. What would be an example of a complex we might say somebody has? How do we use that word? Anybody think of it? Or you might say, I have a certain complex.
Well, inferiority.
Yeah, like an inferiority complex.
That happens before we learn low self-esteem.
Right. You keep up with all the latest lingo. Or you see books, don't you? You go into B. Dalton's or whatever, and you see the Cinderella complex, you know. Or I'm trying to think of another one. Anyway, there's lots of, Jung said, he said, everyone has complexes. That's not the question. The question is, which of our complexes have us? And of course, when they have us, then we talk often about phobias or addictions or certain kinds of dysfunctions. You know, There are lots of phobias. What would be an example of a phobia that somebody might have?
Fear of germs.
Okay.
Heights.
Heights, right. Or claustrophobia, right? What?
Or cats.
Yeah, all right. Okay. I was with a guy this weekend that was going to start a catnapper society because the cats were eating up all his pet birds in the backyard, so he was ferocious about these cats. Other people, my aunt would go crazy. She loves cats, has them all over the place. So. Anyway. Okay, now. And these complexes, Jung said, are peculiar to us. They're unique to us. But at the core of every complex, there's like a nucleus of every complex. Does that look like a core of a complex?
Sure.
There's something that Jung called an archetype. And these archetypes are themes or motifs that we all share in common. In fact, all of humanity shares them in common. And Jung claimed that no matter where you go in the world, you can see in people the same archetypes, but they manifest themselves differently in people. How many of you are familiar with the work of somebody like Joseph Campbell? Any of you heard of Joseph Campbell? He writes a book, one of his most famous books, for example, is Hero with a Thousand Faces. Hero with a Thousand Faces. So, for example, an archetype would be a hero, but that gets personalized in each of us in a different kind of way. Or we all know about parenting, don't we? Or about fathering or mothering. These, for Jung, were archetypes that all of humanity shares, but they get personalized differently in individuals, or they get worked out differently in different societies and different cultures. Now, one of the reasons to talk about all of this before we talk about dreams, for example, is that the dreams are symbolic representations for you of the story of what's going on currently in your unconscious. So in your dream you may have an image that is depicting a complex, or you may have an image that's even depicting an archetype. Okay.
Can you say that again, Scott? Dreams are, what did you say?
I said they're the story, the symbolic story of what's going on in the unconscious.
So your unconscious is interpreting the events?
Right.
In using a symbolic language?
Right. And particularly Jung observed that the unconscious presented to us consciously what it was that we needed that wasn't being paid attention to. So dreams have a compensatory function. They compensate. So whatever it is that we're not paying attention to, the unconscious will present to us unconsciously through. One of the ways is through dream images. Dreams are, again, more complex than that. They, according to Jung, they have a variety of functions, but that's the major function of dream imagery. Okay, now, Jung also said that as we develop, we also develop certain masks that we use, like hats that we wear in different situations. We're not the same in every situation. Good example might be, some of you maybe have been or are school teachers, and one moment you can be very inappropriately angry with the student, and the next moment very nurturing. And then you go to lunch and you have lunch with your colleagues, and you behave a different way with them. And then you go home to your spouse and your, you know, lover, friend, companionship relationship. And then you meet with your own children and you have parental relationship. So we don't react the same way to, you know, in every situation with everyone. And in fact, if we do react the same way, then we have a problem. You know, some ministers never take their collar off, you know. So they're the same with their kids and their parishioners and their spouse. And we have a terrible problem as ministers sometimes. We get so identified with our pastoral role, image, that we don't know when to, as I say, take off the collar, you know. And Jung called these ways of relating to the outside world as personas. And claimed that a mature person actually has many personas that they can appropriately take off and put on, or masks that they take off and put on. And they need those. Because if you just let all the stimulus of a day or all the people just run over you all the time without any protection at all, then of course you become the same. On the other hand, if you have just one persona that you use in all situations, you can see where that would be inappropriate. So the goal, Jung thought, was to develop a variety of these personas that one could put on and take off. Now, one of the problems with personas is that these personas tend to a certain extent be culturally determined. In other words, our society, our parents, and so forth, tell us how we ought to be with one another. I grew up thinking, for example, that, you know, young boys, young men ought to be a certain way. A young man ought never to cry in public, for example. That was a part of my persona. I can remember when I left my first church, after having been there, and I broke down and cried that Sunday. I didn't do it intentionally, it just, you know, it came over me. A couple of men came up to me afterwards and told me how embarrassing that was, that a grown man should do that. And they were really embarrassed for me. I thought it felt pretty good, actually. But
they had a certain persona of that too.
Yeah, right. Well, they you know, thought that men shouldn't do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Probably, especially a pastor, a leader.
Yeah, especially a pastor, a leader, and so forth. Right. Now, what happens with men is that if you're a man, you also tend to develop what society thinks is a male persona, a way in which to interact with your outer environment. You become, you know, an image of what you think maleness is. Or a woman, you become what society tells you a woman ought to be. And so all the opposites of that tend to get buried in the unconscious. So you might say a lot of characteristics or traits that were associated with being a woman, for me as I was growing up, I was told that I shouldn't be that way, like crying, or that was associated with women. So the opposites of all your persona go into your unconscious. There is what Jung called a contrasexual nature to the psyche. My personas tend to develop for me in a male way, and so the female dimensions of myself got buried largely in the unconscious. And actually this it develops as a complex with a core archetype, and if you're a man, that would be called the anima, and if you were a woman, it would be called for Jung the animus. In other words, if you as a young woman, we're told by your society what all young women ought to be like in relation to other people. All the opposites of that got buried in the unconscious. Jung called that the animus. And a lifelong task for Jung was to try to get those two things back together again. So one of the most popular images for a man, for example, particularly in early life, throughout their life, in their dreams, often would be anima figures. And I want to ask you men, to reveal this publicly, but I'm sure if you think back, you can think about some pretty risque, you know, exciting dreams that you've had about women that you wouldn't dare confess even to your wife for fear of being embarrassed, or she for fear that you were maybe going to run off with some of these dream images. And women have the same kinds of things with masculine images, not necessarily in the same way, but they often have a lot of wise men kinds of images in their dreams, or men that they look up to or respect, masculine figures and so forth. Now Jung said what's going on here is we're trying to get ourselves back together again. We're trying to get the rejected side more into consciousness. Now another way, in addition to dreams, that we know about what's in the unconscious is through what Jung called projection. Somebody comes along out here, particularly this happens in this last case when I was talking about, for example, for a man who has buried a lot of his feminine characteristics or sign is unconscious, along comes a woman and he projects what's in his own unconscious onto that woman, and she carries for him the feminine side of himself that has been buried. And that's one of the ways a man learns about his own feminine side in his unconscious. The trick for the man is he has to find out if he really loves this woman before he marries her. You see, he runs off with her. Because often what he runs off with is his anima, his own anima. Then he discovers that this woman is a real person too. You know, then he has to decide whether he really likes this person he's married, irrespective of how much of his own anima she carries. And the same thing happens with women, only this is a male figure. She projects her animus onto this, or the buried masculine dimension of herself. Runs off with the man, then she has to discover, she has to find out whether or not she really likes this person that she's projected onto originally. So projection, in addition to dreams, is another way that we find out about what's in the unconscious. Also, it's through the feminine, because the feminine is buried for the man, that he finds out a lot about what's in the unconscious. And it's also true for the woman, that she finds out a lot about what's in her unconscious through the masculine dimensions of herself. So one of the big polarities is this whole masculine-feminine tension. Now, there's another interesting complex that we'll talk about for a minute in the unconscious. In addition to this feminine-masculine thing, as you were developing as a child, there were a lot of things that you were punished for and told were not acceptable. These don't necessarily have anything to do with masculine and feminine dimensions. For example, I was told as a child that anger was unacceptable. Anger was unacceptable in my household. My parents never got angry publicly. I don't know to this day if they ever got angry with each other. But if they did, it was always behind closed doors. And so anger was a no-no for me. Even if it was legitimate, you know, you buried it. So that became a part of my unconscious material. Well, you know, along comes Joe over here, who is one of these guys that gets angry. And of course, Joe scares me to death. You know, or I don't like Joe. You know, I just don't like this guy at all. You know, I think he's evil, the devil. Why am I so uncomfortable with Joe? Well, you see, what's happening is that I'm projecting onto Joe. And the content of all of this stuff that I wouldn't be caught dead being, because I was told that was all wrong, from anger on, you know, a whole list of stuff. Jung called the shadow. And you'll see a lot of books out today about the shadow. And Jung felt that if you're going to be a mature person, particularly a mature person spiritually, the very first task that you had to do was get in touch with the shadow and stop projecting it outside yourself onto other people. If you meet somebody and you just don't like them, you don't know why exactly, you just know that you're uncomfortable with them, chances are, it's like Pogo says, you know, I met the enemy and he is me or he is us or something like that. How's that?
We are met
them
and
they are us.
They are us or something like that. Right. I'm sure you've all met people that you're just uncomfortable with. Or it's happened to you. You know, you've walked into a situation and somebody's uncomfortable with you. I mean, you haven't done anything, you know. You just showed up. And they're uneasy or they're mad or they don't like you or something, you know, and you say, well, why is that? I'm a likable person, you know, I mean, what's going on? You know, well, there's some projection. Intimidation, meaning where they're trying to intimidate you in some way.
You feel intimidated.
If you feel intimidated by that person, right, there could be some real projection there on your part.
Yeah.
They maybe haven't done anything at all, it's just that you feel intimidated. Or there's an interesting switch here too. The shadow, because it's everything you wouldn't want to be caught dead being, also represents a tremendous amount of your potential as a person. Jung said that the shadow is 80% golden. And so it can also be people that you admire tremendously or are fascinated with. You know some of these evangelists that are just, I mean, their theology is absolutely abhorrent. Some of these, particularly a couple of them that are now been discredited, I have to confess that I was fascinated by these guys. I couldn't stand them, you know. I didn't like what they said. I knew what they were doing, you know, in terms of manipulating people. But I'd sit there and watch it, make my wife nauseated. She'd leave the room and make me turn off the TV, get angry. But Baker and Schweigert and so forth. So I remember I decided, well, I have to deal with this. You know, what is my fascination with these guys? Because I think I stand for everything they don't stand for, vice versa. But so I went to this analyst I was working with, and I said, "What, you know, I don't understand. What is it that captivates me about these people?" So we began to work on that issue, and I finally decided that what it was power. They had tremendous power over people, and that one of the things that I had been taught as a young person was that power was evil. Power ultimately corrupts. So I had to get in touch with my own power as a person, you know. In other words, I think what the psyche was saying was, Scott, you need to get in touch with your own charisma, your own power, and use that creatively, you know. Don't just eschew it, but get in touch with your own power as a person. But I'd been projecting all of that onto, you know, these people, and I was fascinated by people of power. So that's an example of how I projected my own shadow. Okay, again, all of these images will come up in our dreams. And you can think of specific ways in which they may have. Years ago, when we had a president of the United States that said, I know where evil is, where the center of evil is. It's not in this country. And he named the country and the place. Well, there's a good example of a projection collectively of power. And I must confess that I grew up kind of with that notion too, that evil resided, you know, on a national level. It was projected outside of my own country onto all evil in the world started in one place in the world. So there was not any owning of it ourselves or myself, but it all got projected. And of course, what that does is that creates kind of an objective evil out there. But that's a whole other subject. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about consciousness, and then we'll get into talking a little bit more about dreams. See, is there anything else I want to tell you about? I want to tell you about two other things. One other complex in the unconscious. It's actually in the unconscious, but it functions at the center of consciousness. Is a complex called the ego. And this is actually an unconscious complex, but it functions at the center of consciousness. And that's become a popular word. Popular psychologists today in America are ego psychologists. They function largely with consciousness and not with the unconscious. But the ego is the unconscious complex that sorts out for us what is going to remain conscious for us and what's going to go into the unconscious. When you're driving down a freeway, for example, you don't remember consciously all the cars that come your direction. You may, for one reason or another, pick out a few that you remember. Or if you're taking a trip, you'll remember a few places, you know, along the way. But you don't remember everything that comes. Our ego is working all the time to sort out what it is that's going to come to our consciousness and what it is that's just going to pass right through us, or is going to go down into the unconscious. Developing a strong ego is really important, Jung felt. A very weak ego, if this is a very small ego, allows just everything to pour into the unconscious on the one hand, or everything in the unconscious to come out unchecked on the other hand. There's no barrier there. And that's why a good, healthy, strong ego is important. The last thing we want to do is give away our ego. I cringe when I hear some preaching these days that talks about, you know, our ego being the problem. Really what people are talking about is egocentricity, which is something else again. And that's where egocentricity, something like that? I don't know. I haven't got enough letters in that.
What word is it?
Egocentricity. Egocentricity. Anyway, guess I got me. Egocentricity. There we go. Okay. That's when the whole world has to revolve around us. That's what egocentricity is. And if you come into a room, and if one person wants to take over, you know, that would be, without the permission of the group, that's egocentricity. And but developing a strong ego is really, really important. Otherwise, we become insane. And we can't function in a society. So developing a healthy ego, positive regard, self-esteem, those are all related to developing an ego. Now there's one other concept that Jung had. And in the very center of all of this was a principle that Jung called the self. And that's, in some ways, the most hypothetical of all the principles that Jung observed. And the self is the organizing principle of the psyche. The self decides what it is that needs attention and presents that to us in terms of dreams, in terms of projections, and so forth. And the self, Jung called the image of God within us. Not God, but the image of God within us, organizing this whole mess for our own flower, for the purpose of our own development and our own flowering. And he felt that this religious function in the psyche was a given, was an empirical fact as far as he was concerned. And this is another reason why Jung and Freud split, because Freud had no way or no concept of a notion of a religious function related very much to God beyond the person. That in some way organized our forward goingness and our development. Okay, anything you want to ask about any of that mishmash of stuff? I'm sure there's a. Well, let me do one more thing and then we'll get into some bit of time. In terms of how we function consciously, Jung felt that if we just took the top half of this, actually this should be like a ball and you can spin it around in many directions because what's up and what's down doesn't make any difference really. But the way we function consciously, Jung felt that all of us preferred one of two attitudes. We were either more on the side of introversion or more on the side of extroversion. And none of these ideas for Jung were better or worse. It's just that we tend to prefer, and we all have them all, we just tend to prefer one or the other. An introvert for Jung was a person who tended, when faced with any given situation, would look inward first for a way to sort out what they were facing. The problem they were facing, the person they were facing, the situation, whatever they come in contact with. An extrovert is a person who would tend, their first knee-jerk reaction would be to look outside themselves, to see what's going on outside themselves before they go inside. This has nothing to do with who is, you know, the most fun at the party or who's going to be the wallflower. Although extroverts tend to be more the life of the party, but not necessarily than introverts. I have developed a number of social skills over the years, but I am personally a very strong introvert. An introvert is someone, for example, if I, after a Sunday morning of preaching and shaking people's hands and so forth, I would be absolutely a limp dish rag, and I would need to go off by myself, get my battery recharged before I could go out and be with people again. I love people, but they wear me out. On the other hand, an extrovert just gets charged up by being with people. And if they are feeling down or whatever, they need to go out and find some people to do something with, you know. Let's get something going here. And so that gives them energy, where for an introvert it tends to take away energy. So an introvert tends to get their batteries recharged by being alone, and an extrovert tends to get their batteries charged by being with people, for example. In a given situation, an extrovert will be very keenly aware of what's going on outside. And being the director of the village, I have to make sure that we've got some good extroverts in the village. Otherwise, the whole place might burn down and I wouldn't notice, you see. Because if I'm okay inside me, then the world is fine as far as I'm concerned. I mean, you know. On the other hand, if I'm not okay inside me, then somehow the whole world is rotten. You know, and it may be a beautiful sunny day out. And things may be going just fine, you know. So what's going on inside of me is very important to me. With an extrovert, what's going on outside is very important to them.
Is it very likely that a person that might start life as an introvert or would switch over as a result of some experiences and become this?
Well, Jung claimed that we basically stay the way we are throughout our life. What's happened for me is that I've moved from being way out here to in here, and this has moved farther in this direction, but I'm still an introvert. Now, some theorists say that there is a progression through our life and that we actually will switch over. Also, what can happen is we can compensate. Like we get married, and if we're an introvert and we marry a very introverted person, one of us may decide to take on an extroverted role to compensate for the other person. And we think we're an extrovert, when in reality, we're really still an introvert. And all of these issues come up in our dreams, by the way. Now, Jung also said there are four functions. And the four functions are thinking, they come in pairs, feeling, intuition, and sensation. And we tend to develop, one of these tends to be the most developed function, and the opposite tends to be the least developed function. This is how this axis here, sensation and intuition, is the way in which we know things. And this axis here, thinking and feeling, is the axis in which we make value judgments about things or how we're going to decide about things. So intuition and sensation are the ways in which I tend to know what's going on in the situation. I'm a very intuitive person. Don't confuse me with the facts. I already know what the truth is. as a parish pastor, I could walk in and after a few months I could have a pretty clear vision of where this institution needed to go. I wouldn't have a clue how to help it get there. I needed other people who could, you know, say, now, Scott, this is what we need to do, you know, A, B, C. See, I could tell you where we are, I can tell you where we need to go, but I need sensation folks to help me say, okay, now, Scott, what you do, you know, this is step A, this is step B, this is step C, and so forth. When I meet with someone on a one-on-one relationship, particularly after a while, I'll begin to develop a pretty strong intuitive sense of where that person is, what some of the issues are for them, and so forth. Don't ask me how I know those things. I don't know. I just know. Some of you are that way. You have a more developed. Other people are very sensation oriented. Reality for them is what you can taste, touch, smell, hear. You know, the senses. And if they can't taste it, touch it, smell it, see it, it's not real, you know. Right, Eritha?
Fifth
on the field, right. So that's how they take in information, if it's related to one of the senses. And again, both of these are equally of value. And what happens is that, for example, I get tripped up a lot if I don't pay attention to sensation-oriented things. I had to learn that that's my least developed function. So I really have to, you know, sit down and pay attention to, you know, the porch is sagging out here, and we need to, doesn't matter how I feel about it, you know, the fact is the thing sags, and I need to go take a look and see what the problem is, and we got to see if we can get someone to fix it, you know. Now, thinking and feeling, that's how I make decisions about things, whether I value them or I don't value them, whether I like them, how things fit together for me. And I tend to be, these are fairly close for me, but feeling is more developed. So, for example, in a parish setting, I always want to know how people feel about things. That's more important to me than who's right and who's wrong. You know, we could be dead wrong, but if everybody feels okay about it, then that's fine with me. But I found in a parish I was always scurrying around making sure everybody felt okay, you know, about whatever it was we all decided to do or not do or whatever, you know. So if you were my parishioners and we were going to vote on something, you know, I'd be less concerned about whether it's right or just or correct or really the thing we should do. But if you all felt okay, then that's fine with me. But if you didn't like it, didn't feel good about it, then I was having troubles, because how people feel about it or how I feel about it is a real important thing. Now other folks are much clearer. They want to be clear about, you know, now Scott, what are we doing here? You know, what does this mean? And is this right?
You mean the facts, man.
What?
You mean the facts.
Yeah, particularly if you put these two together. Although most professors are thinking intuitive types. Jung called this N and this F. They represent a very small minority of the population, but they represent 60% of the clergy. Sensation represents about 75% of the people. Intuition about 25% of the people. So you have professors in seminary who are all NT, teaching people who are mostly NS, dealing with people in congregations who are largely S in their orientation. There's two other categories we haven't got into called J and P. J's are folks who like to have things very orderly in their life. Actually, I'm a J as well. I suppose that's why I can be a director. And P's are very much into spontaneous kinds of things. SJs run the world. And those are the people that are in our congregations mostly. But they're mostly ministered to by NFs who don't have a clue what SJs are about. In fact, NFPs. I often say a good P is a person who arrives at an airport and has 2 hours before the next plane and has a good friend who lives an hour and 10 minutes away. I have to get to the airport an hour before the plane leaves. Drives my wife crazy. But I'm just a nervous wreck. If I'm not there, you know, sitting in my seat, got my book out, and I'm ready to go, you know. Jeanette said, we're wasting all this time. We could be doing this and this and this, you know. And why do we have to get here, you know, Connie?
This is what makes our trips exciting. I want to be there on time, and the team sees the waterfall. You better believe it.
Yeah. Now we all need each the but you
tell
know.
Me again what the P stood for. J is orderly, P is spontaneous.
More spontaneous. Yeah. Yeah. It's called perception. Well, they want a P wants to leave things more open ended. they don't want to make decisions too quickly. There might be some more information we need. Jays want to make decisions right now, whether we got all the data. Yeah. Let's make the decision then.
But why do you marry the ones who are the opposite?
Because you need each other.
It'd
be dull if you married your same type. You'd all be going this direction, you know, instead of more inclusive. And a lot of these struggles, again, show up in our dreams. That's the story of our dreams. And we all have all of these things in us. It's just that we tend to prefer. It's like we have a right hand and a left hand. We can use them both, right? But you tend to prefer to write with one or the other, or bat with one or the other, shave with one or the other, brush your teeth with one or the other. You know, I mean, you prefer one over the other, but you have them all. And some people are, you know, how many of you have taken the Myers-Briggs type inventory? Yeah, well, see, that's what this is. This is where the Myers-Briggs comes from. It's from Jung. Myers and Briggs are a mother-daughter team that took Jung's typology and developed it into this inventory, which is now the most widely used inventory, psychological inventory in the country, and used for all kinds of purposes. It has interesting staffing implications, because when you're staffing an organization, you know, you need a variety of people. You just choose people like yourself, you have a wonderful time, but you get nothing done. I used to have a colleague, his wife would kid us. She'd say, you know, you two can sit for an hour and say absolutely nothing and have an absolutely wonderful time. And that was true. We were both on the end and the eye out here. We were just off the scale. We thought we were having a conversation, sitting there doing nothing. And Oh dear. Okay, now dreams. Dreams are symbols about us and what's going on with us. What's needing development, what some of the issues are, what's going on here. You know, maybe our unconscious wanting us to get more in touch with our sensation, or we were in a situation where let's say I was in a situation where I didn't handle it well at all, because I really didn't pay enough attention to my sensation side. And so sometimes the dream then will rehearse some of that for me. Dreams can simply be anything from, you know, we didn't pay enough attention to what was going on today, to some very deep and profound kinds of issues. Dreams are 99.9% about you, even though you may have a lot of other people in your dreams that you know. Mostly what you're dreaming about is yourself. That isn't to say you can't dream about other people. People do that. But basically, most dreams are about what's going on inside of you. And the language that you're dreaming is symbolic language. So if you dream that you die in the dream, it doesn't mean that you're going to die. It doesn't mean that you can't dream about dying. But all the research that I've read suggests that even with people that are dying, they continue to dream about their growth or dealing with what the issues are in their life. Most dreams that you have, at least as a starting point, need to be seen as dreams about something that's going on with me right now that the unconscious is wanting me to pay more attention to. And dreams are wonderful because they have classic, wonderful dreams with all kinds of weird and strange characters. And others of us have rather mundane dreams. My wife has much more dramatic, classic dreams that you could write about. Some of you will dream of figures that will stay with you and reappear in your dreams, or maybe even in daytime fantasies or visions of various kinds. Some of these figures even become kind of inner guides for people. And so, well, worn you out here with all this stuff. Yeah.
Could paranoid be included in your
thought? Yeah, well, a person is paranoid, particularly about something, or just about many things in general. It probably relates to one of these complexes here. Paranoia can develop from a variety of sources and from a variety of reasons, where one kind of lives in fear often of various kinds of situations, or just generally in fear that something terrible is going to happen.
Is it paranoia if it's true?
No, then of course it's reality. But if that's what you mean. But most things that people are paranoid about are not true. And so, of course, the classic treatment for paranoia is to keep acquainting people with reality or with the truth, so they can't live in that paranoia. Is that what you mean? So somebody that's way out on the scale of paranoia. Now, we all have a certain amount of paranoia that develops from various insecurities, low self-esteem. It can develop from a variety of reasons. Some people have more of a tendency to that than others. Some people feel that people are out to get them. And it could be that they lived in a family where people played a lot of games with each other all the time, and they never really knew for sure, and they were never secure in their relationships. I've had to deal with kind of the opposite problem, kind of naivete about people. I basically believe in everyone. And it's been hard for me to accept the fact that some people actually can be very conniving. You know? And that, you know, as an administrator, I am at fault at times for not being firm enough with people. And setting boundaries and saying, now if you step over this boundary, then, you know, you stepped over the boundary and you're going to have to leave us. So I've had to struggle with kind of the opposite issue.
I had a 3 months that I felt was very significant in changing my role in life, and that was that I grew up in a home with 3 brothers, and I was given a lot of praise for being kind and good to all my brothers and girls, you know, serving and helping with the little ones and so on. But this continued farther on than was really appropriate. And I dreamt that we were on a train trip, and when we got to the trip, my 3 brothers ran off to play on the beach, and I kept gathering up all their belongings and getting them off the train and just loading myself down with things that they should have taken care of. And then I saw a figure of my father who had died some years ago. He was shining and bright like an angel. He said, Carol, you no longer have to do everything for your brothers. And I just dropped all their junk and went off and had left this out.
Okay, there's you see your animus represented in the dream by your father. It's telling you to take charge of the situation, do what's needful, and so forth.